You have Lynn and Bruce in Estes Park at the House of the Rising Sun. Or actually, we are in the House of the Rising Sun.
Literally,
the sun's rising
figuratively.
Through the window.
Uh-huh.
But we're here at the beautiful YMCA of the Rockies. And we're here for an exciting, amazing workshop, which is the Weekend of Freedom Retreat. And Bruce is a presenter. He spoke yesterday and just made everybody just laugh their butts off. So I call that successful. Anytime anybody laughs when I'm teaching, that's a success. So it was good, very, very good. And we've had David Hoffmeister and Gary and Cindy Renard and
Maria Felipe.
Maria Felipe.
Nice presentation.
Oh my gosh, yeah. She was amazing.
Yeah. And some healers and all kinds of good
some
stuff.
Some healers and some healing. Yeah, so what's going on with you, Bruce?
Well, first of all, thank you for, number one, introducing me to this event, which I didn't know about until you mentioned it quite a few months ago. I think it was
last October, maybe?
I think it was last summer, even.
Yeah, it was last summer.
I think
that was last summer. Yeah.
That's and, right. And then I kind of got wind of it and kept up with it because it sounded like a really neat idea. And in the interim, while being there and I should say now here in Colorado, I moved to California, now back here for the time being. And I really appreciate that introduction. And it's been just wonderful getting to know all the people here and getting to know some of them that I met previously in Las Vegas a few months ago better, and some that I'd known for years even better still. So and the presentations have been great, and it's just been wonderful to be here. And this, I think the next one might be in Utah, and that's still to be determined.
We're talking about Hawaii.
And Hawaii would be fun. That's right. That's right. So anyway, for those who may not listen all the time, Lynn and I get on once a week, and we talk about A Course in Miracles, and usually pull out something from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles Frequently Asked Questions. And I found just in my sequential reading and yet another one that seemed like it would be a good candidate, which is FAQ number 1155. That's 1155. And these are all, if you go to facimoutreach.org, you can see all the Q&As. And if you look for the sequential numeric listing, that goes from 1 to 1,300 something. I forget how many high they go up to, but this one is at 1155, and it's basically a question. Well, why don't we start reading it? Do you want to read the first paragraph?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah.
And I did post the link in the room, so if you wanted to go to that link, or I'll repost it and follow along. That's also a
While you're doing that, I just want to say again that this is really fun because Lynn and I have been doing this for, what, about 6 months now, give or take?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. And at Lynn's invitation, because I was having, you know, frequent issues with Pal Talk, getting on and having the connection stay put and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And she said, well, why don't I just, you know, Skype you in? And then we discovered how much fun it was to do dialogue rather than a monologue. And so the conversations have been just great fun. And so this is the first time we've actually
done one
in person. literally rubbing elbows. Yes.
Hope you combed your hair, because we'll put us on the cam.
Oh, we'll get a video too. Huh?
We can actually see us.
Oh.
Let's see here. Don't laugh. Yeah, it's on. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, there we are.
Hello.
Lynn and Bruce.
Howdy.
Move this down a little bit. So you can... Ooh, we look ghostly. The light is really bizarre.
Well, we're sitting here in the lobby of the Emerald Lodge at the Estes Park YMCA.
Give you a little tour.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So anyway, we don't get to do this every week, so this is kind of a special event. Yeah.
But I'm going to turn that off because I recognize that.
Probably don't need that much bandwidth.
It doesn't help.
Yeah.
No, we don't. Yeah. Absolutely not.
So yeah.
We make that
but that's fun. Yeah.
There we go.
So this is our first live remote.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess we don't need that.
Or at least my first live remote. You've probably done others, right?
Yeah, because anytime I travel.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we probably don't need these anymore because we're not going to listen to anybody
that's
else.
Okay.
Just you and me.
Yeah.
So let's go And Bruce, you want to start reading the
question? Sure, this is 11:55.
Can you see okay?
Yeah, in the frequently asked questions. And it starts out, my question is about what appeared to be a glimpse into the deeper meaning of A Course in Miracles that I experienced. I seem to see the world from a very different plane, but essentially I was aware of the fact that everything in this world meant nothing. It was all a cardboard cutout.
Oh, I got to stop you there because that's exactly, we were talking about this yesterday. I was telling David Hoffmeister, when I was a kid growing up in these mountains, mm-hmm. it looked like cardboard cutouts. Everything looked to me like cardboard cutouts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And here's somebody with the same question.
Yeah.
So go on.
Well, just to add to that, some of the studies I've done in multidimensional geometry, just a quick aside, there's... You know, we think we're in three dimensions of space anyway, but mathematicians that are really into this stuff have discovered that you know how you can have a cube in three dimensions, and then there's four other shapes called a tetrahedron, octahedron, icosahedron, and dodecahedron that Plato is credited with naming. Well, it turns out that in four-dimensional space there are exactly six equivalent shapes in four dimensions that are called polychora, and the general term is polytopes. And when you get to the fifth dimension, which not to be
exactly
you got it, you got it. Well, it's a little different than that one, but the same spelling, right? And there's actually exactly three regular polytopes, and they've proven, mathematicians have proven that in dimensions five through infinity there are exactly three regular polytopes that appear in each of those dimensions that have all those properties. But what's cool though is that basically,
wow,
we just have a limited dimensional world. That, you know, because
yes,
we really are seeing the shadow, and that's kind of how mathematicians describe it. Is if the Edwin Abbott's Flatland is a classic story that came out about a century ago, I guess.
It's on the United Beings.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah.
And that whole metaphor is a great one, because if you think about, if you lived in a two-dimensional world, someone wanted to pull a prank on you from a three-dimensional world, it'd be like, let's say your two-dimensional world was a sheet of paper.
Mm-hmm.
If someone from a three-dimensional world could have a little mischievous fun at your expense by poking a pencil through your world, right? And you would suddenly see a black dot appear as the pencil lead went through your reality,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay, and then you'd see that black dot get bigger, and then it turned brown when you get to the wood part, right? And then it turned into a yellow hexagon.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that yellow hexagon would persist for a while, and pretty soon it would magically change back into a circular shape, maybe green if it's a little green band,
mm-hmm.
at the top, and then it would collapse down a little bit more to a pink circle, and then it would disappear.
And then it would disappear.
And then they say, call National Enquirer for Flatland.
Yeah,
right?
There's something, yeah.
Yeah,
there's aliens or something.
Exactly.
Something's happened here.
But we're so immersed in our idea that, you know, in this cardboard cutout of three dimensions, which is really a shadow of, you know, dimensions we can't even comprehend and probably shouldn't strain our brains too hard to try. But it's a good reminder that, you know, we just see a tiny, tiny,
yes,
infinitesimal portion of even within this dream we call 3D reality. So it is a cardboard cutout world. You know, it really is a facade.
It's a Barnum and Bailey world.
Yeah.
Just as phony as it could be.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
Exactly. And the me that really makes sense to believe in is the essence that we all share, rather than something that's special to just certain persons or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
exactly.
And if we can remember that and just you know, click into that awareness that's like, oh yeah, I could, that's really what takes us out of the land of make-believe and into reality. And what a gift that is.
What a gift. What
yeah.
a gift. So you're two sentences in.
Yeah, we had a good good digression on the
7-Eleven, I think.
Oh, okay. Good. That's good. I remember that slogan, that campaign. That was our digression on the cardboard cutout, so I'll continue. And we're reading FAQ 1155 from facim.org's Frequently Asked Questions. One of the very strange descriptions that came to me was that there was absolutely no difference between placing my toe on the floor and the war in Iraq, or anywhere for that matter. Everything, including myself, only existed through the specialness given it. The awareness that sensed all this was not lying in the bed, yet it was me. I was somehow able to switch between this awareness and the me, probably should have quotes around there, that I knew. No longer believing in my life as I knew it, I felt a great darkness come over me. I had no alternative insight into what was real. It was then that I made a conscious decision to opt for the cardboard world I knew, as the fear of the unknown was overwhelming. I always imagined that a realization of this magnitude would be accompanied by a great sense of love, that might be or joy, showing you what is your reality. But I had none of that. Is there a fear barrier that must be crossed simply through trust? And does this sound like an experience of vision, in quotes, or was it just the ego's meanderings?
Oh,
what a great question.
That's a great question, and yeah. I've had experiences similar to this, actually,
okay.
And
okay.
I'm sure you have too.
Sure.
And so this is something that happens to people, and the question always has been, what would it take to make the leap from that state of mind into a permanent state of knowing?
Right.
And I'm sure they're going to say something about the fear and the cause of the fear and that being, I'll read.
Okay.
Before
I'd like to tie this into the real
that.
Alternative section in the last chapter too.
Before
we're
done.
Do
you want to go look at it, or do you want to?
Well, to briefly mention, I think there's a really, and if I was talking about that yesterday too, is. Because I think that's a real easy thing to do, is to forget that we need to not only in the development of trust that this curriculum involves, not only focus on the shared interest that basically get rid of the differences that really are a manifestation of the fear, because the shared interests basically provide us with an identity that replaces the fraudulent identity that we made so real to ourselves, and that fake identity is a fearful one, because if we think we're essentially all alone against the universe, that's a no fun kind of thing,
yeah.
And that's very it can be very frightening.
Yes.
And then the other aspect to the shared interest that really is just a different way of looking at it ultimately, because we use words to describe things that because we think they're different, but it's really, in a sense, the same thing, and that is trusting in our inner kindness teacher, which is really, placing our faith and transitioning our faith over time more and more to the awareness that remembers that the little self that we think we are is just a silly dream. It's just,
it's not
anything that we need to panic about or to get upset about or make a big deal about, which I read through this morning. They use that phrase again, which I think is a great one, because when we make big deals out of things, it basically is saying, I think this is real. I think this is the whole enchilada.
Right.
When we're looking at one little tortilla crumb.
Right. When somebody's pushing a pencil through our world.
Exactly.
And we're like,
Exactly.
It's a vision. Something wonderful is going to happen to me. Yep, it's gone.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so.
We don't see the whole picture.
Yeah. Don't see the whole picture. And, what people tend to want to do, and I've seen many, 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 many people do this, is they have an experience like that, and they believe that they have become somehow or the other transformed or, that was it. And if it's crappy and you're unhappy and you're miserable and you're in a dark place, then you just think, well, that's what happens. You go into this dark place. I thought I was going to be in bliss, but really, really, I'm crappy and unhappy.
Somehow I hear a camp song, since we're in a perfect setting for that.
Really,
if you're crappy and unhappy, clap your hands. That could be Iga's new mantra, right?
Oh, that could be absolutely. And so people do have that. And so I'm going to read this because Jesus talks about this a lot.
Yeah.
People don't recognize Jesus is really telling us that these things happen, and that we're being shown things. We're being seeing glimmers of light around things. We're seeing things, and things are happening, and we're having a different experience. And the purpose of the experience is really to give us the hope or the notion that, you know, there is something different, mm-hmm. that what I think I'm seeing is not really real, and there is something more to that. And the reason that we don't accept that is because ego says to us, oh, you just made that up. That's imaginary. You actually fell asleep. You didn't recognize it, and you were dreaming. And, you know, you were walking in your sleep. Or, you know, ego says all kinds of stuff. And many people have these what we call like mystical experiences. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they either make it into a big, huge focus on their life, and that is a point of their existence that they refer back to every time, like, when I had the revelation, this is what happened. When I had the insight, this is what happened. Instead of, you know, why am I not having that now? Uh-huh. If I had that and it had some meaning to me, why am I not choosing to have that right now?
And the form is always a specific, and the yes. specific is always a form. And so when we have an experience that is different from other experiences, that's usually another clue that we're treading on ego's turf again.
Yeah.
Because how could perfect oneness and you know, eternal perfection change? How could truth vary if truth is true? It should be true everywhere and every when.
Yes.
And so if we have an experience that can come and go, that's usually a clue that, you know, it might be a decoy.
It
might be a fraud.
Exactly. But they're not they're not here to bait and switch.
Right.
You know, they're here to give us a glimpse or give us an idea that there's something beyond our own thinking.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's really all you need is to really come to understand. It's like I know when I was like 12 years old and in school, and I was having a terrible time because I really disagreed with I went to Catholic school. I really disagreed with I was beginning to see that what I thought was real, mm-hmm. what I thought was the most important thing, was really a sham. Mm-hmm. and so it was making it very, very difficult for me. And, I was thinking, what was it? It's something that, the coming of age in Samoa, believe it or not, Margaret Mead.
Yeah?
I read Margaret Mead writing about the people in Samoa, and I realized, these are people that have a different experience than me, and it is completely valid,
mm-hmm.
and it is amazing and wonderful, and, you know, not repressive, and not, you know, it's a whole different kind of culture and society. And I realized that what I thought was normal was not normal in any way at all. And that that realization just shook me to the core, and I just started looking around and thought, what else did I think was mm-hmm. real and really is not? And it really, you know, I went through some, you know, formative years of being just shaken up by things. But that's how Jesus does it, or that's how the Holy Spirit does it. It's those are the miracles that were put into the illusion at the beginning when the script was written. The Holy Spirit put a miracle behind everything that happened. So there's a miracle behind this. We're in the miracle right now.
Exactly.
And so, you know, those are always there. They're like Easter eggs for you to find.
And I think some of those you know, ephemeral, shall we say, mystical experiences can be a reminder. And if it's something that is inspiring, that can be a reflection of the mind's choice, but the important thing is to remember not to stay fixated on something
that is
something specific, because
right.
that's really not the goal of the curriculum. And the goal is to find the peace that doesn't change,
right.
and you know, is eventually choose completely against the fake alternative,
exactly,
which is the fear.
Exactly. It's like I was listening to that. There's a little thing I got from the foundation that's Ken and Bill and Judy talking about Helen.
Uh-huh.
And they were talking about her subway experience, mm-hmm. where she was in the subway and she was looking around and seeing that everybody just was, you know, dirty and disgusting, and she was in, and it was horrible. And she, then all of a sudden, she actually saw nothing but the light. She saw the Christ. She saw the vision of everything beautiful, and you know, it was a completely shift of experience for her to actually see that. And so, if you had an experience like that, would you ever get off the subway? Would you? I mean, this is the question. This is the
it
question.
It must be the subway person, that's doing it, right?
This
yeah.
is the question the person is asking.
Yeah, yeah.
Is,
yeah,
you know,
we can laugh at that, but we do that with all the things that we make big deals about, don't
exactly.
we? All the specialness idols that we make. Yeah,
yeah exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, and if it was me, I probably would go on that subway every
yeah.
day.
Yeah, got to go back to the scene of the mystical experience, let alone the crime. Right?
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. Yeah. So, okay. So, do you guys remember what the question was?
Yeah. Just as a recap, we're on 11:55. We just read the question, and I think we're about.
I mean, check and see what people are saying. If
about,
anybody's mentioning
yeah,
anything,
yeah.
okay. No, it's just Pal Talk doing its thing.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So refresh us on the question. Bruce.
Okay. Yeah, it's basically, you know, someone's had a, you know, a fearful experience that and was hoping for a wonderful mystical experience, and they were thinking that, well, gee, what happened here? Why did I not have something that was wonderful, basically? I'm paraphrasing greatly.
Yeah. That,
yeah.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, and so basically it was a question about fear.
Mm-hmm.
I had an experience that seemed like it was should be heavenly, and I ended up in a different state of mind altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the kind of experience addressed in the section in the text called Light in the Dream. Then that's in text chapter 18, section 3, as well as in other places. As light comes nearer, you will rush to darkness, shrinking from the truth, sometimes retreating to the lesser forms of fear, and sometimes to stark terror. I know that. If you knew who walks beside you on the way that you have chosen, fear would be impossible. That is probably one of the most compelling lines to me in the course.
Mm-hmm.
And any time I'm afraid, I whistle a little tune. No, every time I feel afraid, I come to this. If I knew who walked beside me, I would not be afraid. And, you know, so that's Jesus obviously saying that. You do not know, because the journey into darkness has been long and cruel. You have gone deep into it. A little flicker of your eyelids, closed so long, has not yet been sufficient to give you confidence in yourself, so long despised. You go toward love, still hating it and terribly afraid of its judgment upon you. And you do not realize that you are not afraid of love, but only of what you have made of it. And that's from text chapter 18. And so, I mean, this really does explain that the whole ego, one of the veils of oblivion. You know, it's one of the things that you think you get into this place, and what I think the fear is that if you accept this, it's been my fear anyway when I've been in this, if I do this, I'll never be able to come back. It's like you want to take the red pill or the blue pill, you know. Choose one and you'll never come back no matter what. And and that's a frightening thing. If you think that things will never be the same for you again, as much as you might say you want it, as much as you might say you want the peace of God, what's the very first obstacle to peace?
The desire to
get rid of it.
Yes, I think that was one of the quotes I pulled out yesterday.
It was. And so, you know, the knowing of what is it that I really want, you know, I may say I want the peace of God. Say these words means not
to mean it.
To mean everything.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it. And so, this is one of the core, the way the ego works. It's one of the core mechanisms that it uses to hold on to us and to keep us in, not because it's evil and wants to hurt us, but because its job is to keep us in the dream.
Right.
The whole purpose of the ego is to maintain the dream, the quality of the dream, to an extent that we will not be seeing things outside of it and wanting to go out.
Right.
Why else would we continue dreaming? We have somebody who's lulling us into keeping it up because that's its job. We made it for that purpose.
Exactly.
We made it for the purpose of keeping all this in place so that we could play here and not go back home. So then you got to come to, what is it that I really want? And you have to know that you really want it. And the only way to do that is to forgive this world.
Exactly.
So,
and I think part of that is seeing how dysfunctional this matrix dream really is. And seeing that you know, we may have moments that seem to go well. And sometimes people have seemingly have whole lifetimes,
yeah.
That seem like, well, what's the problem here? You know, why would I want to return to this alleged perfect oneness? You know, because we think, well, nothing's wrong here.
Right.
And yet, sooner or later, we encounter that unconscious stuff that is really the thought system of sin, guilt, and fear that the Course describes, that basically is, you know, what this paragraph is saying is, you know, the stark terror of realizing, well, there's something more. Because if there's something other, there's always a fear. And the fear is always basically born of an unconscious guilt over the idea that there was some kind of mistake that was irreconcilable.
Yep.
And that's, yep. I think that was one of the most comforting ideas when I first read the text, you know, about 30 years ago, and I remember reading some of it while backpacking in the Sierras, my dog-eared book became known as the backpacking edition. And yes, literally pages were falling out, you know, because I read, you know, it kind of got a little bit abused in that, those kind of trips. But I remember reading how the difference between sin and error was so vital, because sin, if it were true, as the Course says, would be irreconcilable.
Right.
And there's no way out of that.
Right.
And from within the dream, it seems foolproof.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Course says, but it's not God-proof.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And the reason that would be because if sin were possible, if sin was real, God would not be.
Yeah,
if
exactly.
God is real, sin can't be.
Exactly.
And if that's something that until you actually look at it and recognize that the two can't coexist.
Exactly, exactly.
Then you got to know that, right. You know, it's impossible.
Yeah.
And you know that, and so the difference between sin and error is huge.
It is.
It's saying,
yeah,
God is real or God is not.
Yeah. And the error, the beauty and the grace and the mercy, if you will, of error is that the error gives us an opportunity to see that this can be fixed.
Right.
This is just a simple decision in my mind, nobody else's, that I can make.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
The peace that I've always wanted is a decision that I can and will and even metaphysically have already made, but I'm just dreaming that I'm having this experience that is in this bizarre matrix of holographic projection that seems to have indicated that God was shattered, the perfect oneness,
right.
and
we
perfect
change God.
And
somehow
our perfect innocence
God.
Somehow got smashed in the process, and Humpty Dumpty couldn't be put back together again. But that never happened. It was only in a dream, and that's where I think seeing the illusory nature of it can lead to these kind of experiences if we're not accustomed to taking the hand of our inner kindness teacher.
Yep.
And going through it very, you know, not necessarily slowly, but consistently with that kind of guidance and that kind of perspective. And it is a mind training process to remember to take that inner metaphoric hand of that inner kindness teacher.
Exactly.
And see that really does lead us consistently out of the fear.
Yeah. Absolutely, and it does, because as you go along, you are remembering.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, you know, look in the Course and see how many times he says remember.
Yeah.
Remember, remember, remember. That's all we're doing.
Uh huh.
And so, you know, that's not a simple process. Although it's simple, but it's not easy. I think that's what Jesus
right,
says.
Right.
It's simple, but it's not easy. And the reason, you know, people either give up or they think they've got it or whatever. But if you're still experiencing fear in any form, then there's work to do. And so, you know, you say some of these things become more bizarre, which is true, that, you know, things that happen, things you see, the world itself. I mean, look at the world, the state of the world itself is as bizarre as it can be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is the purpose of that? It's not to, you know, it's not karma, although it is in a way, because it's what I want to see. And, you know, either I want to see it because I think it's real, or I want to see it because it's showing me that it could not be possible. And it just is another a chink in the armor of the illusion. And really, yeah, it's the cracks in the world that's letting the light in.
Yeah, beautiful.
So you want to go to the next paragraph?
Sure. The process of the Course is really a gentle one, but it nevertheless can lead to a sense of disorientation as we make a radical shift in our perspective of reality. Jesus explains this and reassures us. Now, this is a quote from chapter 16 in the text. In the transition, there is a period of confusion in which a sense of actual disorientation may occur. But fear it not, for it means only that you have been willing to let go of your hold on the distorted frame of reference that seemed to hold your world together. Fear not that you will be abruptly lifted up and hurled into reality. Time is kind, and if you use it on behalf of reality, it will keep gentle pace with you in your transition. And I think that's such an important, important, crucial, and comforting, soothing, merciful reminder that we don't have to, you know, as Gary Renard was saying last night in the building a couple buildings over from here.
Miles away from
here. Well, that's a big campus here. YMCA. I had no idea it was so big. But he was, you know, saying, it's really, it can be an easy thing. We don't have to be crucified. That was, you know, we had an elder brother who chose that experience. But he, at that point, he already recognized that there wasn't any order of difficulty in miracles, and one form of healing was no different from another. So it was no big deal. But, you know, we're not asked to do that. We're not asked to make sacrifices. In fact, if we really allow this to sink in, there is nothing in the world that happens or doesn't happen that could possibly be a sacrifice.
That's right. Everything's a gift.
How could we be giving up anything if everything that we believe is real in the world is truly nothing? It's a holographic projection of a tiny mad idea. Then, of course, we're not consciously aware of that all the time. So the Course meets us where we're at, and that's why we have a very slow, progressive process given to us. And that's where, you know, I think the release, I think, is the word. Something like that, yeah. But basically, you know, when we let go, you know, I like to think of the ego's hold on our mind, which is what we made, is like a white knuckle grip that we have on a fake identity. And you know, it's another metaphor I like is if, you know, our inner kindness teacher shows you that there's a climate controlled escalator up the backside of Mount Everest, you know, and we're with our pitons and our axe hammer, you know, our ice hammers and our, you know, ice axes and ropes and you know, all kinds of fancy ladders and gear, trying to get up the, you know, the more, you know, arduous and frightening face, you know, and we get this little tap on the shoulder. Psst, hey, there's a much easier way to do this.
Exactly.
But we don't want to hear that. And I think that's where, you know, it's helpful to remember. This is just a silly story, like one of Ken's audios I was sharing yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
The excerpt from.
Well, that's one of my favorites. I play that over and over.
Taking the ego
so
lightly.
Good.
Because we don't take it lightly most of the time. We take our perceptions of this world, whether it's a special love of, oh, wow, we're in this beautiful place, and now, in a little over 24 hours from now, we think we'll need to go somewhere else.
Right.
To someplace that maybe is not as nice. Well, that's just, again, the dualistic thought system saying that there's differences in the dream that are important.
Yep.
Now, on the level of form, of course there's differences. But do those really matter? does matter matter?
Yeah, no, yeah. Well, yeah, and actually, even on the level of form, the differences that you see, when I saw something yesterday at supper, I was watching a group of kids, and we're at this YMCA where there's like hundreds of, maybe thousands, I don't know, yeah. Kids, people, babies, people. I mean, it's just amazing, the population here. And we all go to the same place to eat. And so I was waiting kind of for some people to show up, and I was watching this group of kids. And, you know, looking at them, they were all like, they're, you know, tall and thin and short and fat and, you know, all these differences. And they're all dancing and jumping around. And I looked at them and kind of, I had one of these little glimpse things where actually I saw them like cartoon aliens. And seeing them like cartoon aliens, all of a sudden the differences that I was looking at, saying, thinking, you know, well, you know, he's going to grow up to be a fat guy, or, you know, those kind of things that were in my mind, all of a sudden when I looked at them as aliens, I didn't see any future for them. I wasn't thinking about what, you know, what they were doing when they were not here. I was not thinking about, I was just seeing, oh, there, it's a form of,
we are among the aliens too,
right.
Lynn. not to disturb you, but we are among the aliens as well.
I am an alien.
but that we're aliens here. You know, we don't belong here. And I think that's where Lesson 182, which I'm listening to Ken's commentary over and over on my iPhone, for maybe I'll play that if there's an opportunity.
Because
there's so much, you know, peace that comes from recognizing that we do have a voice that constantly is beckoning us home to a peace that couldn't possibly change. And that's what we all, you know, we could describe it differently, but that's what we all really want. We think that the innocence that is our true nature, that is everyone's true nature, somehow was compromised, and that we had a hand in it. And on the level of the dream, we did. Yeah, we all individually and collectively made up a dream whereby that innocence was lost, and that perfection was tarnished, and you know, the self that we all share somehow got fragmented. But that's just a crazy, crazy illusory idea.
Yep.
And it's an interpretation, because, you know, the pixels, so to speak, on the screen of our mind, even the photons that hit our retina, they don't have any meaning until we add that meaning to it. Because as I'm looking across the lobby of this mountain lodge, and I'm seeing, you know, wooden railings and a big rock fireplace and coffee machines and microwaves across the room and trash cans, and I assign meaning to all those things. But as the photons hit my retina, they're just patterns of vibration that don't mean anything until I say, oh, that's a microwave, or that's a trash can, or that's a door at the top of the stairs.
Right. Yeah. And think about just being a newborn baby.
Mm-hmm.
You're newborn, and you look around, and you see, what do you see?
Right.
You have no idea.
Right.
You have not a clue what anything is.
Yeah.
It just all seems like shifting forms.
Right.
And you can't tell where one ends and the other begins. There's no, you have no context. And what Jesus is trying to do is point out to us that the context, the meaning, all the lessons that we have that say that I know what this table is, that's erroneous thinking.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to go back to those newborn eyes and look at it and say, I don't know what anything is for.
Yeah.
Nothing I see here means anything.
Yeah.
If it does, I gave all the meaning to it. Let me look at the meaning that I'm given to these things. And I had a conversation with a lady last night, and we were talking about that in particular. And I said, well, you know, what do you know about me? Look at me and tell me, what do you know about me? And, you know, so she starts telling me, oh, I see your hair, I see you, you know. And then, and I said, do you think that what you, so you know something a little bit about my family, you know a little bit of something about my personality, my body, all these things. I said, do you think that this person over here knows these same things? To me, to them, I'm a completely different person. To you, I'm a certain kind of person. To them, I'm a different, to you, to me, you're a different kind of person than that person. I look at you and think, well, you're a lady and you've done this thing and you walk the Camino and you've done all this stuff. And I look at him and I think, you know, he's a guy and he lives in California or he lives in Colorado, or those are all meanings I gave that have nothing whatsoever to do with what you truly are. So it's all what I see. I'm making you up. And people don't get, you know, that. I didn't get it for a long time. I am actually making you up right here in front of me. Mm-hmm. And what I see is in my own mind and nowhere else. And
pretty talented fabricators, aren't we?
We're really talented fabricators. But unless you can get that, you know, I really am the one who's, it doesn't matter if, I mean, it may look, Bruce may look entirely different to somebody else. Blue may look entirely different to somebody else. Sky may look, we don't know what anyone else sees. But we assume that we do. And we assume that you see what I see. And so when you act in a way that is not in accordance with what I think, then you're off the track. But that's it. It's my own mind that's making it all up. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And until you get that, you're going to keep going along thinking you're a victim. So so you hear these stories. He's talking about you will not be abruptly lifted up and hurled into reality. And then you hear these stories of people who have had these experiences like we're talking about, and then, you know, it's changed their lives and they become in a different way. And, you know, sometimes I know people that have gone in the mental hospital because of this stuff. So and then they've complained, you know, I've been lifted up and hurled into reality, and that's not right. But that's not reality.
Yeah. And I think that underscores the importance, again, of focusing on, as Ken Wapnick points out in his introduction to the Journey Through the Manual for Teachers, is that, and we're all teaching all the time, one of those two thought systems. And if we don't, if we choose to ignore the shared interest, if we focus on separate interests, and if we don't identify with that inner kindness teacher, no matter what words we apply to that, you know, we're basically just asking for more fear. It's not really going to be different than any other kind of fear, but, you know, we might, because the ego's focuses on differences, it may make orders of difference of fear a big deal. And in that respect, we may think we have an experience that's more scary or more challenging or more whatever than some other experience. But if we look back over all the dream chronology of our lives, we can probably, in all honesty, say, well, in a way, they're all the same.
Yep.
But the sameness, again, is not an ego's vocabulary, because the sameness leads to oneness, which ego can't even comprehend. But the sameness, not on the level of form, but on the level of content of the mind, where we see everyone and everything as having the same goal, which is awakening to the oneness that we never left. With that awareness, we then can go through and any experience and find the peace.
That's right.
Through that. And that's where I think it's so important to remember to focus on the shared interests, focus on taking the hand metaphorically of our inner kindness mm-hmm. teacher and looking for ways to make it about the other person and to express the kindness in however way we can, because that is going to prepare our mind for a peaceful experience when we inevitably, you know, it's all a matter of when, within the context of linear time that we think we're in, you know, drop our identification with all the stuff that you know, seems to make the world real.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the lessons of the Holy Spirit are really the ones that bring us into that. Yeah. Those three lessons are the ones that really focus us in that purpose. And so, you know, to have, give all to all, you know, it's not give everything you have to everybody else. It's to give the Christ to everyone you
right,
see.
Right. It's all you about know? Mind, isn't it?
It's all in the mind. Yeah. So if I want to have the Christ in my mind, I have to give you the Christ, and
right,
I have to
right.
assume the Christ in you, and I have to not, I have to look past all those other things that seem different and recognize that there's only one thing that's the same, and that is our Christ nature. So to have, give all to all, give everyone their own Christ nature, give that in your mind, and allow them to be that. And then to have peace, teach peace to learn it. It's the same thing. That's what you're doing. When you're giving all to all, you are teaching peace. When you're looking only for the Christ in your brother, you are teaching nothing but peace and remembering God. And then, of course, the last one, to being vigilant for God and His kingdom. That means look at this thing that you think you see and look that God and His kingdom are here. You're not seeing it because of this right. illusion that's in front of you.
Right.
So when if you practice those three lessons, forget about the other 365. Because you will come to the point where you're actually seeing the truth.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So you get that, want to see what I denied because it was the truth. Huh? Yes, I do. Thank you. So let's see, where are we at? Okay, the questioning of your reality and the world is a necessary step in the direction of total relinquishment of your ego. A part of you, the ego part, of course, is terrified of this. Yet, Jesus says, in this learning is salvation born, and what you are will tell you of itself. And that's from text chapter 31, section 5. When you calmly realize that your whole existence as a being in the world was made by you, let's see. I lost my place. Okay. Was made by you, the decision maker in the mind, as a defense against the truth, then you would also realize that to dismantle this powerful defense would expose the overwhelming fear that motivated you to erect it in the first place. So you start taking down the walls and you're going to start seeing, oh, there's the thing I tried to hide. It is at this stage of the process that we encounter the most terror without realizing its cause. This is described rather graphically in the Two Worlds section in chapter 18 of the text. There Jesus talks about the willingness that is needed to follow the Holy Spirit through seeing the terror, trusting Him not to abandon you and leave you there. For it is not His purpose to frighten you, but only yours. You should have that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's another good comedic example.
Bruce had a bunch of examples of Jesus saying pretty funny stuff to us, like resign as your own teacher because you've not been taught well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but that's a funny thing to me, too. So he says,
yeah.
It's only your purpose to frighten yourself. You are severely tempted to abandon Him at the outside ring of fear. But He would lead you safely through and far beyond. So this is it. You know, we're still not ready to totally relinquish the ego. And that's why when people have these experiences and they come out of it, they haven't relinquished the ego. In fact, most of the time, this is one of those strategies that keeps their ego firmly in place.
Good
because
point.
They go through their life saying, and I had this experience.
Right, and then it scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
And so I'm not doing that again.
I'm not doing it again.
Yeah.
But it becomes a part of their persona.
Right.
And it's not what you are either. So.
Yeah. And it's not, the Course isn't suggesting that we have those kinds of experience, because it's suggesting that we consistently learn to take the hand of our inner kindness teacher, to see the shared interest, to find the kindness that we never left, and then from that perspective, the experiences that we have that seemingly are more of a mystical nature then become very gentle, easy experiences.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going to go get some water. This coffee is so strong.
Okay.
I can't drink it.
Are you getting some water? Oh, okay.
Do you need some?
If you can get some water.
No. Okay. Yeah.
Great. Thanks.
All right.
And I'll read the next paragraph.
Read the next paragraph.
Yeah. Okay. Far beyond. Okay. So the next paragraph goes: Jesus is thus aware of the fear and terror in our minds, but He wants to be a comforting presence to us as we go through this process, as He knows our fear and terror are unjustified. And that was one of the things that I was sharing yesterday that at this Weekend of Freedom retreat that to me has been very helpful, is that the unconscious guilt that we think is real from the perspective of a seemingly separate self is we have this wonderful mechanism that really is a gift that we get to see what's in our unconscious minds. And without that, we would never have a way back home. But we have an opportunity through this forgiveness classroom to look at everything that happens in our world and see it as an opportunity to look at the contents of our unconscious mind. And what it's really revealing to us is the unconscious guilt, the whole unconscious sin, guilt, and fear thought system. Whenever we feel the least bit of discomfort or dis-ease, whether it's a physical discomfort or a mental one, because ultimately they're all mental, even though that's another challenging concept to the self that we think we are. But it's unfounded. That whole premise is unfounded. It's unjustified. It's unwarranted and unsubstantial. It basically means that whole insane premise doesn't have any bearing in truth. And it's just silly. And another favorite phrase from Ken Wapnick is, it's not evil, it's not sinful, it's not wicked. It really doesn't have to be fearful, because it's just silly. It's just silly that we would believe that somehow we left perfect oneness. So I'll start that over. He wants to help us to reach that same realization, but that means we must be patient and gentle with ourselves and allow ourselves as much time as we need to make the transition. What helps enormously is not to make a big deal about the process.
Thank you.
After all, we are undoing only what is illusory and restoring to our awareness only what belongs there and is natural. Our fear of loss is terribly threatening as we begin the process, but all that we will, quote, lose, unquote, is our guilt, anger, anguish, and hatred, and we will become more kind, more forgiving, more compassionate, and more peaceful. That is not to be feared, but welcomed. And it will be if we remember who walks with us. And there it is, that inner kindness teacher that we've never left, but sometimes we forget to ask for that counsel. And we don't have to ask in words. It's just really more of a willingness to say, I want to see things differently. Yep. I want to, there must be a better way, a way that's beyond the self-interest of an ego that you know, is always trying to battle the cosmos because it thinks it pulled off an idea of separation.
Yep.
And makes a big deal about it.
And just going to, again, I always like to bring in a practical, and we can go on past this because we're supposed to be doing a meditation at 8:30, but
okay.
I'm not sure if Phil's going to do that or what. Although I came in yesterday and Phil was doing a meditation that blew me away, I think, and he recorded it. So it was very, very good. But just to reiterate here, which is something I always like to do, because I notice even here that a lot of the teachers will talk about, you know, this guilt. But for a long, long time, I would just look at that and go, I don't feel that.
What guilt?
What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. But then I guess one day, and this is after I actually started doing the Byron Katie work.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and I started looking at what I felt responsible for in this world. Mm-hmm. And I realized that and they do it to us from like early childhood. They do it to us from the moment we are able to even understand things. Even before that, we start seeing the guilt, how responsible I am for the world. Okay,
right.
Starving children in China. You know, you go to church and they stand up and they talk about, you know, we got to give to the missions. There's people who really need help. And, you know, your mom gave you a dime to put in the collection basket. And you have to think, you know, I can take this dime and go buy an ice cream after church, or I can put it in the basket. And man, I really want the ice cream. And so you put it in your pocket instead of in the basket. And then you go around all the rest of your life knowing that you caused thousands or millions of people to starve to death because you didn't put that dime in the collection basket.
I mean, you're the one, huh?
I'm the one. These are the things that cause. And it's not just that. It's, you know, you look on the TV and there's, you know, pictures of, you know, these abused animals need your help, and you know, someone's singing a sad song and your heart goes out.
Even public radio and TV uses the guilt mechanism. Yes, yeah, like, you should support, you know.
Well, right. Of course, they're one of the causes, but
you know, obviously using the guilt as a mechanism is a little questionable sometimes.
Right? But that's the whole world. I mean, you get it from the very beginning. If you really want to know and look at your, and I did, I started looking at my all these things that I felt responsible for and guilty because I wasn't making a difference, and I realized I'm responsible for all the suffering in the world. Every bit of, if you stub your toe, it's my fault because I didn't move something or, I didn't warn you there was something to stub your toe. I'm always going to feel guilty. And so you have to look at that and recognize that all of that is a fabrication of your own imagination. And that if I were responsible for everything that was happening in this world, then I should be guilty. You know, I'm bad. Because it sucks. But that's not true.
Right.
And that's the whole point here.
Well, ironically, actually, what you're saying kind of reminds me of an idea that is probably even more challenging, in that on the level of truth, within the, you know, in other words, within the context of our seemingly individual minds, we are responsible for everything
that
seems to happen in the world. But that's where the unconscious guilt, which is projected out, we get the reminder that it's unfounded, unwarranted, unjustified, and unreal, because we're looking at a hologram. We're looking at something that does not exist in truth, but we're so fixated on what's not true that we use that to condemn ourselves. We use that as a means to keep ourselves and each other imprisoned, and that's just silly. That's just silly. So should we read the...
Let's see. Carrie says, I'm supposed to feel guilty for taking the money out of the basket when I was 10. Well, I don't. At least I don't think I do. I bet you do, buddy. I think you should look at that, because I think you didn't tell anybody about that. You didn't go home to mom and say, oh, hey, mom, you know what? I took the money out of the basket. No, you didn't do that.
What basket? Now, on the level of form, obviously it makes sense to do the things that are kind and however we can to make the world a kinder, more benevolent place. But if we can use that as a reminder to look at the contents of our mind and what's behind that, you know, the inner shield of oblivion, which is really the thought system that keeps all that stuff in place, that's really the important thing. And that's where our inner kindness teacher, like Toto, pulls back the curtain and says, "Hey, look here. There's nothing to be afraid of. It's just this fearful little man who thinks that it can maintain some kind of control over a dream world, a fantasy world like Oz, in our mind, where you know, by reigning with terror, we think that we can keep the terror from us, which of course is insane, you know, and today's workbook lesson, you know, there's no cruelty in God,
none in me.
Because
it's a beautiful lesson.
Because, you know, if we can be gentle and see that there's no reason for being in fear or promoting fear, either way, I mean, and then it becomes silly. It's just silly.
It does become silly.
Yeah.
And Carrie says she saw you take the money. Hopefully she didn't tell you to take it. But do you you think about all the little things, and believe me, when I started looking, and I was doing the Byron Katie work, I started looking at this stuff, and I did. I just sat and cried. I cried and cried and cried. I cried every tear that I never cried in my whole life, because I, couldn't face my own thoughts, my own guilt. But, you know, I saw things that I did when I was, 6 years old that I've, was terrified of, because of the guilt that I was feeling from it. And, when I looked at it, it was nothing. But it seemed like something at the time because, how can a dime save everyone in the world? It seemed like, it was huge, but no, not at all.
Well, I remember reading something on something when you said dime, it kind of triggered a remembrance of an article on the physics of rocketry, and that basically the thickness of a dime at the moment of launch can send a rocket to a different planet.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, which kind of makes sense, you know, it's like a very small, but that's actually can be a very encouraging thing. And it kind of ties into this FAQ, that it's really a gradual, gentle process, that we just have to make these gentle corrections, yeah. You know, the thickness of a dime, the seemingly little things, whether it's a minor irritation or annoyance, there's no order of difficulty in that. So any correction that we make holographically fixes the whole thing. But within the comforting approach that we use to guided by our inner kindness teacher to undo that ego thought system, we seemingly need to make a series, and usually in a long, elongated, protracted series of decisions that lead us back out of the dream in a gentle way, which is what this whole FAQ is all about.
It's all about.
Should we read the last,
Let's go,
paragraph? And then,
I think we're doing pretty good.
Yeah,
here.
We might even make it to breakfast.
Yeah. Okay. So where are we at? The last one? Okay. One last point. While it is true within the illusion that there is no difference between placing your toe on the floor and the war in Iraq, it is true only when you are with Jesus above the battleground. And this is the big difference.
Bingo. Bingo.
People keep trying to say, well, it's not happening to me right now. And this, you know, I don't see it. I don't feel it. No, because you've got to go with Jesus
right.
above the battleground.
Right, right.
You have to ask him to help you see it differently.
Yep.
And so, and he says, missing this distinction could lead to denial of your experiences in the world. Good morning. Where differences must be respected. This crucial distinction is the basis of what Jesus teaches us in Lesson 187. There he explains that you give but to yourself. And anyone who truly understands this must laugh at the idea of sacrifice, nor can he fail to recognize the many forms which sacrifice may take. He laughs as well at pain and loss, at sickness and at grief, at poverty, starvation, and at death. He recognizes sacrifice remains the one idea that stands behind them all. That is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Sacrifice
mm-hmm.
is the one idea. That is what it is that really keeps all that guilt in place, is this belief that I must sacrifice,
yeah.
that I must, and twisting the word, I must atone for my sins.
And the ego the thought system is the ultimate sacrifice, because it's a substitution
yep.
for a perfect peace that could not possibly be
yep.
changed. But we're dreaming. We're only dreaming that we lost that. We're only fantasizing in this elaborate technicolor, you know, special effects laden production that we call 3D reality, that where that seems to be at the whim and at the mercy of things outside of our control. But we made it up.
We made it up, and we are perfectly in control of all of it.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
though it doesn't seem like it,
right.
because we want to have the experience.
Yeah.
What
were we thinking?
I want this experience. and that's another thing, just to add a little side in. That's why denying our experiences is not helpful.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
all we're doing is reassuring that we're going to come back and have that same experience
right.
again. It's only when you look at the experience and you practice the forgiveness process with it that you actually let it go, and you don't have to do it again. You know, Gary and Cindy were talking, or Cindy especially was talking about collapsing time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is how the miracle collapses time, is you learn this lesson this time, you don't have to go through it the next, you know, next life, whatever. You can actually skip through pages in the book and whole chapters
right.
in the book. You know, so you don't have to experience, you know, it's not, it's in the script, doesn't mean you have to do everything that's in the script.
Right, right.
That's why we have the miracles, so that we can slip through those cracks.
I think we sort of like jump, forgiveness, quantum forgiveness, as Gary's teachers call it, helps us make the transition from one parallel illusory reality to another, but we move to more gentle ones more quickly.
Yes, yes.
We're not changing the script on that particular dimensional matrix, but we're just moving from matrix to matrix
right.
within the dream of multiplicity. And why not have a gentler, happier dream and have those more quickly and spare
yeah.
ourselves the grief,
the grief of
unforgiveness.
And it may not even be a different experience as far as the actual happening of
mm-hmm.
the experiences in your life may be completely different. not different in any way at all than
right.
they would have been.
Just interpretation.
It's your interpretation.
Yes.
So,
yes,
so
yes.
you know, you find someone like Thich Nhat Hanh, who seems to be a very peaceful person. Does that mean that everything that happens in his life and the world is a peaceful, wonderful thing? No, he had a stroke. He's, you know, been ill. But to him, he's in heaven. He could be in hell. And that's the difference. You can be in hell or heaven, whichever you choose, you know, one or the other.
Moment to moment.
Moment to moment.
Yeah.
So, so this is the looking at these things that we call sacrifice, sickness, poverty, starvation, death, all of those things are not real or even necessary. And so taken out of the context in which Jesus is presenting this lesson, these statements can make him sound cruel and insensitive if he says it means nothing that you're
right.
suffering.
Right.
But it's you have to be the one that has to understand that it means nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It is essential to understand, therefore, that his reference point and yours in your experience is the mind joined with his above the battleground.
Bingo.
And
Bingo.
That's when you join with that whatever you want to call it, Jesus or the Holy Spirit or, you know, whatever, the force, whatever you want to call it, when you join with that and let it be the interpreter, then you no longer see the cruelty. And in fact, you actually see what has happened for me is I see that every person in this world is experiencing what they're experiencing so that they can wake up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, if they appear to be suffering, it's not my business
yes.
to deal with that, because if I took it away from them, it's like, you know, cutting open the cocoon to let the butterfly out. If the butterfly doesn't break out of it on its own, the blood doesn't go to all the parts of its wings and it's crippled and it can't fly.
Yeah.
You know, we're crippling people when we're trying to save them from their experiences. It doesn't mean that we're not kind to people and
mm-hmm.
compassionate and helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Just means that, you know, it's not up to me to try to take over your life and your pain and be in charge of you.
Yeah.
I'm not.
I have a mathematical formula that I use for that.
Okay, let's
hear it. It's very simple. And that is, we're actually charged with being responsible to everyone in our life, but not for everyone in our life. So there's two is half the effort of four.
Oh, two and four.
because when we're responsible to everyone, we're basically saying, on the level of the mind, I can consistently respond to every call for help, every call for love, with love. And that's being responsible to all of the creation, you know, as we experience in this limited realm. But we're not responsible for everything, because as seemingly individuals, you know, we each have our seemingly, you know, individual minds that we're in charge of.
Yep.
And so we return to that. And I think that's why in the early section of the text and the discussion about cause and effect, he says, I would be working against your best interest if I were to take away the power of your decision.
Take your own responsibility for yourself away from you.
Need to have the recognition that we can choose against the ego, and that's where the freedom lies, and that's where, if permanent exhilaration is a word,
mm-hmm.
I'll make it up,
yeah.
you know, a phrase. but that's really where the peace comes from, is realizing that we have that choice at every moment, and,
yep.
and that's our freedom.
That's it. That's
beautiful. And we can do it in a very gentle, easy way, as this FAQ addresses.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I wanted to thank you, Bruce, for
thank
deciding
you, Lynn.
To come over here and do
this. And
this has
been fun to do this live as a remote.
I love being sitting next to you and not being, you know, back and forth on the Skype. And it's very, very cool.
Thanks for setting all this up.
Yeah, and I'm going to turn the mic back to you guys. We're going to go and have breakfast. And I forget who's on this morning, but maybe Lori Coburn or somebody.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
So as we have a lineup ahead of us, I'm going to try to hook something up tonight, but I'm not sure what's going to happen. So pretty much the folks here have told me Lynn, this is your time, and you shouldn't be here talking or messing around with Plow Talk. But you know me, and Bruce said he'd come and join me with this morning, so I love it.
It's actually been fun because we've been seeing some of the people at the conference,
right,
and, who've been waving and smiling at us as going up and down the stairs in the lobby of this hotel.
It's very, very cool.
Yeah.
And so I'm... You know, looking forward to, and there's some people that come in this room. There's a lady that I met last year at the Way of this Weekend of Freedom. Well, I've known her for a long time on Facebook, and she's in the Disappearance of the Universe Yahoo group. But she told me yesterday that she listens on the radio a lot.
Great.
So and she says I've started listening, and it's so great to hear all these wonderful things all day. I say, you know, this is great. We don't know who we're affecting
exactly,
by this.
Exactly.
So,
thank you so much, Lynn, and have a great week, everyone.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Bruce.